Good evening, everyone. I'd like to call the study session of the University City Council to order at 5:30 on October 28th. Before you have the agenda for tonight's public session. Are there any changes to the agenda? Paulette.
I would like to consider under the city manager's report, economic development, retail sales tax, board recommendations that we consider each funding separately as opposed to one.
Okay, I don't know if that's a change, but you want to go one? You want to go line item by line item? Okay, all right. Duly noted. Anything else? Hearing nothing else, Mr. Rose.
Honorable Mayor and Council Members, you have expressed an interest in learning more about the fiscal and economic impacts Washington University has on University City. With that in mind, I have invited Carson Weiss from Tischler Weiss to provide you with a presentation that would explain briefly what that type of study would encompass, as well as provide you with an opportunity to ask any questions that you might have. So I'm pleased that Carson joined us tonight, and we'll let him introduce himself and as well as proceed with the presentation. Thank you.
There we go. As Greg mentioned, we've been in discussions about the fiscal and economic impacts of Washington University, and I was asked to talk to you tonight. And what I thought I would do is just sort of give you an overview of fiscal and economic impact analysis with an emphasis more on the fiscal side of things, and just sort of walk you through fiscal analysis basics and some examples of how other communities have used fiscal analysis around the country, so that you know there may be other bigger picture fiscal issues that you may want to wrap into a study such as this. A little bit about myself and our firm. I've been doing this type of work now for 29 years. I've led the American Planning Association's Paying for Growth Task Force, and I've been a board member of the Growth and Infrastructure Consortium, and have worked in 39 states now. Our firm is the national leader in fiscal and economic impact analysis, and as well as infrastructure financing evaluations. We've done more of this work than any firm in the country, and that's a picture of one of the books I've written on fiscal impact analysis. And what I thought I'd sort of start off talking about is what we see in the planning process today nationwide, and that is the big issue is the first one, and that is most local governments don't know the true cost of the development decisions they make on a day-to-day basis or whether specific development proposals are fiscally sustainable. And so it begs the question of has or is growth really paying for in itself? And many communities are still feeling a slight hangover from the Great Recession. The National League of Cities has a great publication out that looks at revenue generation by local governments. And this is the first time post-recession, and we're, and depending on who you talk to, we're 6, 7, or 8 years out from the past recession, and local government revenue still isn't at its pre-recession levels, adjusted for constant dollars. And in every previous recession, that's taken about 3 years. Also, a big question cities are wrestling with around the country from our perspective is, you know, should certain types of development be incentivized? And if so, what types? What's the return on investment? And then finally, this is probably not new to you all, but, you know, most communities are experiencing increasing funding responsibilities as state and federal dollars are decreased. And then, you know, how do you make up the difference as those demands on maintaining current levels of service continue into the future? This slide here shows you sort of the elements of the fiscal equation. You have the operating costs, capital facilities, and those costs, and then you see what kind of revenue is generated. And we refer to this as the cash flow to the public sector. And so obviously the revenues minus expenditures equal your net fiscal result. But how is this different than economic impact? And the reason I think it's important we discuss this is that, and I can't tell you how many county commission, town councils, city councils I've been to in the United States where the development community holds up a report, and one of them is shown here from South Carolina, that purports to say, you know, our development project pays for itself. And what happens in a lot of these cases is that there's a blurring of lines between fiscal impact and economic impact. And it's important we distinguish between the differences because the economic impact is the cash flow to the private sector. And it's very different than the cash flow to the public sector. And so when we look at economic impact, we look at, you know, what are the number of jobs generated? What are the number of persons generated? What is the one-time construction phase spending? And construction phase payrolls, and then we have the indirect and induced employment and spending that occurs after the project is implemented. And it's important to note that a lot of this cash flow doesn't stay within jurisdictional lines. It's sometimes regional in nature, and depending on the magnitude of the project, can be statewide in nature. And it's important that we understand these cash flows and whether or not there's a direct fiscal benefit to our local governments. And I think you'll see as we go through this that a lot of that depends on your revenue structure. So you'll hear someone say, well, this project has income of X associated with it. Well, if you don't get a local income tax, you may or may not get direct fiscal trickle-down benefits from this. But that income is important. For instance, if you have a sales tax-based revenue structure, those incomes are needed to purchase goods and services within your community. But it's very important that we understand the difference between the fiscal and the economic benefits. And when we look at fiscal impact analysis, we're often asked, well, what's the difference between what you do versus our finance and budget folks on a regular basis? And there's really two main differences here. One is your annual budgeting process is a fiscally constrained operation by definition. You're looking at past revenue trends to project certain revenues out into the future, and then you're following state revenue formulas for other types of revenue sources. And so by definition, you're fiscally constrained. With a fiscal impact analysis, we're doing just the opposite. We're looking at what does it cost to maintain current levels of service across the board and projecting that forward? And that's a huge assumption because most local governments aren't maintaining levels of service across the board because you are walking that fiscally constrained budget tightrope on a year-to-year basis. And so in order to raise the level of service for, let's say, the police department, we're putting off growth-related capital expenditures or roof replacements, et cetera, in order to balance that budget. So what are the types of questions that can be answered with fiscal and economic impact analysis? Well, there's some obvious ones. You know, from a planning perspective, we look at, you know, what are the impacts of different land use policies and fiscal development patterns in terms of, you know, compact development versus sort of scattershot, you know, lower density development. What's the relationship between the geographic location, the incentives I mentioned earlier, you know, how to invest limited public funds. The timing of impacts, this is a huge one that we deal with in more, you know, really rapidly growing greenfield communities that get on this budgetary treadmill of having to live off tomorrow's growth in order to balance the budget. Annexation is another big one. Other things that we're doing more and more of is looking at, you know, what are the economic and fiscal benefits or impacts of demographic and different behavioral trends. You know, the boomers aging in place. I mean, this is for the last, you know, 8 to 10 years, you know, millennials and empty nesters want to live in the same place. Now, who would have thought that 25 years ago? How's that impacting the cost for services? Behavioral trends in terms of transportation choices, spending patterns. We all are probably familiar with the struggles that the retail sector of the economy has had over the last 10 years and will continue to have into the future. And anybody's guess is how that's going to shake out. And so all of those are things that we've been doing a lot of work in around the country of forecasting different scenarios with these types of assumptions in them. And I'm not going to bore you with the methodology stuff. But one of the things I did want to touch on, and I think this will sort of have us make the leap between the importance of understanding your revenue structure and how that influences the fiscal and economic impact, and that is we have these two big perceptions that we deal with around the country, and that is, one is that everybody thinks that residential development doesn't pay for itself, and that non-residential always generates net surpluses. And I think you'll see as we go through this discussion that it's not that simple, and we need to keep that in mind. One is, so when we look at the drivers of the fiscal equation, the most important driver is the revenue structure, and there's two components of that. What are your growth-related revenue sources, and more importantly, how are they distributed? For instance, in Florida, sales tax goes to the state of Florida and is then distributed based on distributed back using a population-based formula. In a lot of Western states, the sales tax is collected at point of sale and stays in your community, and that has a huge impact on the fiscal equation. What are the characteristics of development in terms of incomes, social or persons per household, pupil generation rates, et cetera? What are the levels of service that you provide within the community? And finally, what is your infrastructure capacity, and where are you in the life cycle of a city? For instance, are you a rapidly growing greenfield city? Are you an aging inner ring suburb? Are you a downtown central city, et cetera? All of those drive the fiscal equation, and I'm going to show you some examples of that. So when we look at the importance of revenue structure as the driver, this is from Scottsdale, Arizona, where the primary revenue source is point of sales tax. And so on a per 1,000 square foot basis, we see that retail generates substantially more fiscal benefits than office and industrial development because of that huge retail sales tax. Now we take those same basic land uses and look at them in Ohio, which the primary revenue source for cities there is revenue or income tax by place of employment, which is different than most states. Where I live in Maryland, it's income tax by place of residence. We see that we have a completely different fiscal picture where office and industrial development generate substantial surpluses compared to retail with the lower wage employment. This is, I think, a very telling analysis from Sarasota County, Florida, that we conducted. And this just shows you the danger of making assumptions about one land use type. And this shows, I want you to focus on Bel Air Estates, Greenfield, and Summerwood. All three of these subdivisions are single-family, or consist of single-family units, but we get completely different results. Bel Air Estates, the influence of the socioeconomics is seen. It's primarily empty nesters. They generated no public school children. Also high assessed values. They're basically McMansion-style development, where Greenfield and Summerwood were more, entry-level and sort of mid-level single-family units with younger families, lower assessed value, high numbers of pupil generation. And so it generates net deficits. And so we just can't say that one land use generates surplus or deficits because it depends on so many different factors. This shows multifamily within Falls Church, Virginia, just the impact of student generation on different bedroom types. Another slide here on changing retail. I mentioned that earlier in the presentation. One of the things that a lot of communities are dealing with, particularly in sales tax-based economies, is what happens when your revenue-generating retail space shifts to services, and as a result, the taxable sales per square foot plunges over time. In this case, community retail is $230 compared to $110. And 10, 15 years ago, you would expect to see at the community retail level sales per square foot of about $330, $335 per square foot. This is an example of infrastructure capacity and sort of where you are in your development cycle as a city. This is Lenexa and Lawrence, Kansas, identical revenue structures. They're about 45 minutes from each other. We show growth paid for itself in Lenexa, but not Lawrence, and there's a reason for that. Lawrence is growing on the fringes. They're having to rapidly expand their infrastructure footprint, whereas Lenexa is an older city. A lot of that infrastructure footprint has been laid, so the cost complexion to serve new growth is very different on a marginal basis than growth on the fringe. Then I want to share with you some fiscal impact analysis in practice. And one of the most common types of analysis we see is at the project level. And it probably also wouldn't surprise you to know that most fiscal analyses prepared in this country are prepared by the developer, not by the cities. It's by the developer. Okay, and so the danger in this is that not so much as being prepared by the developer, but is that you're typically looking at a very optimistic absorption schedule. And so when we look at things at a project level, you'd want to look at different absorption schedules. What happens if the recession, if a recession comes? What happens given the changing nature of retail, that we, some of it shifts to services or offices, or in the case, you know, a lot of places are, we're working right now, we're looking at the fiscal impacts of changing a development plan or development agreement because there was an over optimistic perspective on retail and the market has shifted to multifamily. And so they're having to reopen these developments and look at what the fiscal impact is. So you want to look at different scenarios so you'll be well armed. And the other problem with, or not problem, but danger of looking at things just on the project level is you're viewing them in a vacuum. And you're not looking, or a lot of communities aren't looking at what happens in total. They're just looking at each development in isolation. And so this is an example in Draper, Utah, of a development called Suncrest, where it's built on a mountainside, had its own issues because it was outside of the built environment of the city. But the developer's scenario said, you know, look what a great deal this is for the city. You have a deficit in year one because we have to build a public safety annex up on the mountainside. And after that, it's gravy for you all. Well, we came in and said, well, let's look at some different scenarios. And in this case, well, what happens over 20 years and you only get 75% of the absorption? And you can see here it's a completely different fiscal picture. You don't start to see surpluses until about year 14. And so this kind of information allows you to be well-armed as you enter into development agreements so you can look at, you know, different ways to ameliorate any deficits that may be offset. The second common analysis that we see, you know, we call it area-wide analysis. It can be applied to at the neighborhood level, several contiguous neighborhoods, an entire city, county, et cetera. Usually look out long-term, 10, 20 years. And again, it's common to evaluate multiple scenarios with various land use mixes, paces of growth, or economic activity. This is largely done in conjunction with the planning process. Like, we'll be hired as part of a team that's doing your comprehensive plan, and we'll look at the economics of the visioning process, so to speak. And this example from Queen Creek, Arizona, where this is an example of the city was holding out for retail space, not understanding their place in the larger economy. The development community was pressuring the city to rezone certain areas of the community because there was no market for retail. And so we were hired to look at, do a market analysis as well as fiscal analysis. And lo and behold, the development community was right. There are better places, or other communities are better positioned to compete for shoppers' goods type of retail. And there was a market for density there, which then generates its own organic sales tax generating activity that isn't the large Home Depot or Best Buy of the world. And from a fiscal perspective, changing the land use plan made sense from a fiscal perspective for Queen Creek. And this just shows the results differently. Under the existing plan, it was essentially a break-even proposition, where with the change in the land use plan, you generate substantially more revenue. This is a slide from Hillsborough County, Florida, and the idea here is, or the takeaway here is that, you know, a lot of places, even a city is like this. You just can't treat development homogeneously. There are different areas of your city that have different styles of development, different assessed values, different character that should be reflected in a fiscal model, so that you reflect the type of retail or office uses that you have in sort of the main street type areas versus your more, you know, suburban auto-oriented types of uses. You need to tailor those results into a model so that you can reflect the differences more accurately. And this shows the impact just of using what we call marginal costing. And marginal costing is really dependent on your infrastructure capacity as a city. It's very different than average costing, where in average costing you basically say it cost us so much per person and so much per job to provide fire service. Well, we all know that's not how we provide fire service. How we provide fire service is where are our stations located, what's their current call volume, can we absorb additional calls before we have to build a new fire station? And in many cases, the marginal cost is minimal because you have that capacity. But where you don't have the capacity, the cost structure is very different. And that's why you get these very large spikes in a fiscal equation or a fiscal graph, because you have to spend that money on capital. And then the larger cost is the operating cost. And so that's why this is a much more accurate way of dealing with things. Finally, I want to show you Champaign, Illinois, where we did a three-phase study there. And the big questions there were the fiscal impacts of current land use, and then what were the fiscal impacts of future growth? One, growth within the service area, where all growth occurs in a fiscally astute manner, and then what happens if we allow growth to occur outside of our urban sanitary sewer service boundary. And then we also looked at different ways we could raise revenue without raising taxes. And much like the Hillsborough County example I showed you, we dissected Champaign by sub-area, okay? Because each of these areas of the community had different characteristics in terms of the style of residential and non-residential development. And we see here that growth within the service area was a much better fiscal situation for the community. And this is the most telling graph from my perspective, and that is, you see deficits generated to the capital fund, but the operating fund is generating surpluses. And that's huge, because we don't work in a lot of places where the operating budget is generating surpluses. And that's important, because the operating budget is the budget that is funded by your largest growth-related revenue sources. It is much easier, in our experience, to fund capital deficits than it is operating deficits, because the operating deficits are indicative of a revenue structural problem. And so even though those capital deficits are there, they're very easy to ameliorate. One of the things we found was the analysis supported a tiered road impact fee program, which can make up a substantial amount of those deficits. The other interesting part of this analysis is we reported out the results by sub-area, so you can see that certain sub-areas are generating surpluses and others aren't. And I already talked about this. And so finally, fiscal impact analysis is both a science and an art. And the reason I say that is it is not uncommon to have a fiscal study prepared by one group. I'll give you the example of earlier. The developer's fiscal analysis will show that it's a surplus. We'll be hired. The analysis may show something different. And the reason is fiscal analysis and economic analysis, it isn't like calculating stormwater runoff or trip generation rates, where you just plug numbers into a formula. There's a lot of leeway given the analyst in terms of methodology, the assumptions that go into it. So it needs to be well vetted. And so it's, as we like to say, it passes the straight face test. A one-size-all approach leads to generalizations. I hope that was a clear takeaway from the discussion on revenue structure and the different elements of the fiscal equation. Each jurisdiction is unique. There are peculiarities that need to be taken into the fiscal model for each jurisdiction. The fiscal impacts and the economic impacts are only one part of the equation. There are other things to think about: affordable housing, environmental policies, transportation goals, et cetera. And the idea would be that we look out long term and make sure that our land use plan is fiscally sustainable, so we don't have to get into the arguments for every single development proposal that comes through, because you're going to recognize that everybody has contributors and everybody has recipients from a fiscal perspective. So the idea is to get that mix right so that we know we have a fiscally balanced land use plan. And the goal should be to educate your constituency. And obviously the assumptions have to be clearly vetted with a clear rationale for explaining the methodology and why you chose that direction. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mayor. I have several questions. I'd like
sure.
to go back to Kings Creek, where you said that. Where you said that instead of retail, you were looking at an increased density, and that produced its own organic increases. What exactly do you mean by that,
yeah.
and what might we
sure.
take away from that?
Sure. So, you know, in Arizona, the jurisdictions, the towns and cities rely heavily on sales tax, and what's generated in the community stays in the community. So, obviously, it's important for them to grow the sales tax base. And so, knowing that you're not likely to capture Best Buy, Home Depot, et cetera, and you were a very low-density community to begin with, where density is a bad word for them. There's a lot of, you know, five-acre horse type subdivisions in Queen Creek. They need to realize that from a revenue perspective, if they want to continue to grow their sales tax, they're going to have to increase density and encourage mixed use, because that activity generates its own service and retail uses that serve those residents and still increases your sales tax base without having to go out and rely on attracting the Home Depots and the Best Buys of the world.
Well, if you increase your density, then I would assume you would be increasing the service, the retail services, so that they wouldn't have to drive 25 miles, and
exactly.
they might just have to.
Right.
And that, is that what you were getting at?
Right. And so, there's also the efficiencies that come with density that we see in most cases. For instance, from a transportation perspective, if the density is high enough and there's alternative modes available or other avenues available, so to speak. You have higher internal trip capture, so it reduces transportation maintenance costs and road costs as well.
Okay. And with regard to marginal increases or not, I see that as something that we would be more interested in as you look at our particular problem, which isn't a development, and how that, unless you want to consider the university a development.
Mm-hmm.
It appears that the university has changed what was apparently our goal up until about 2011. We had a way we were working, and I think our council, including me, was a little bit overwhelmed with the not realizing that. I mean, the current buzzwords of, you know, transportation district, walkable, bikeable, and all of those kinds of sustainable, I don't think many of us understood the impacts. And so some of us are still dealing with what was the change a realistic one or not.
Mm-hmm.
And to that, I'll probably be asking Mr. Rose if I can provide you with some of the papers that have gone out there. But it seems to me that that our biggest fear, at least from my constituents' point of view, is the impact that a tax-exempt institution is imposing upon us. And while I think you've just educated us with regard to looking at fiscal impact as opposed to, you know, just our gut feel, how you would analyze that, there are some things, I believe, that are almost intuitive to, you know, to our people. So when our taxes go up because the services aren't being paid for in tax, I guess we might look at what other fees. I think you listed impact fees,
right,
or things like that. What other kinds of things should we be looking at to equalize that revenue stream?
Right. And I don't have the answer for that right now because we haven't actually done an analysis.
Right.
But I should mention that we do have quite a bit of experience in university communities, as well as doing fiscal and economic analysis of the impact of universities. We've worked in Chapel Hill, looking at the impact of the University of North Carolina. We've worked in Virginia, worked in Champaign, Urbana, not Champaign, looking at the impact there, as well as a few other places. So we are familiar with you know, how the universities operate. Evanston, Illinois, is another one. But it's clear that the university has an economic impact to the community. What needs to happen is that economic impact needs to be cycled through the fiscal model to see if all that because you're getting no direct revenue from them, because they're not they're not voluntarily, as far as I know.
No.
Correct me if I'm wrong. They're not paying you a pilot or a payment in lieu of taxes, right? Like, which happens in some communities, okay? So they're not paying you, they're not giving you direct revenue. You're getting indirect revenue from their economic spinoff. And so the real question is when you run that through the fiscal model, is that indirect revenue enough to offset the direct and indirect impacts?
So you would then be classifying or describing and classifying that indirect revenue because, you know, from my prejudiced and very biased point of view, I don't see a lot. And you said there are some that are providers and some that are
recipients.
Uh-huh. And so that's how I see this falling out, more as a provider recipient as opposed to a more equitable situation.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Mayor Crowe. Appreciate the presentation. So this is connected to the Wash U fiscal impact study that we had discussed, correct?
Mayor Crowe, Councilmember Clay, yes, that is correct. It is the first step in the educating the mayor and council on what that type of study would include. In obtaining direction from you later on how to move forward.
Okay, so is this the first of a couple of presentations? Because this, I understand, provided a foundation, but I think somewhat to Councilmember Carr's point, it was not specific to what we are actually desiring to seek, I guess, from a consultant and the end product.
Honorable Mayor, Councilmember Clay, the intention was to provide you with a very general overview of what this type of study would encompass and then outline what I see as being the next steps. I invited Carson to provide you with this information, and that, I think, will assist me if you decide to move forward with creating a scope for this project, as well as creating a calendar so that you can have a good sense of the length of time that this type of analysis takes.
Okay.
So he has not started doing any analysis on University City specifically at this point. It's just giving you a very broad overview of what type of information would be included in this type of study.
And if I may, is it appropriate? Yeah. Just to sort of elaborate, because I already answered some of the questions about sort of how the process would be. But what really drives the results from our experience is, you know, you just can't make a blanket observation or assessment of what the outcome is going to be, because it depends on so many different things. For instance, what's the enrollment? How much of the enrollment lives on campus versus off campus? To what extent are there overlaps between the public safety functions within the university and the community? And those vary from community to community as well. And there are other factors as well that play into it. But we just can't make a blanket assumption about what we'll find until you get into it.
Thank you, Mayor Crowe. Mr. Rose, I'm looking at the copy of the report that was prepared in November of 2018 by Mr. Weiss and his company, and then you sent it out in your city manager report to us on September 27th, just last month. Is this going to be the scope of the study, or what is this document that I'm looking at in reference to what will be taking place in the next couple of steps would be?
Honorable Mayor, Councilmember Cusick, the information that you were provided in 2018 was to give you a general sense of the services that Tischler Weiss could provide. If it's acceptable to the Mayor and Council, my intention would be to provide a very specific scope of services to you and for you to agree to that scope of service and then engaging Tischler Weiss in performing the analysis that we think is needed.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Smotherson.
Thank you, Mayor. I just have one quick question. What's the time frame of a study like this, and what's the general time frame?
Yeah, typically they take around three and a half months. It's sort of the standard.
Okay. Anything else?
I was just going to say, if it's acceptable to you as the council, I'll move forward with creating a scope of service to provide to you. As well as developing a calendar so you'll know specifically kind of what that time frame is going to look like.
Perfect. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. We have a little bit of a break before the public session at 6:30. Thank you.